You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 170. Today's episode is about a benevolent society formed in the early 1800s called Economy Hall. We'll discuss its purpose, the members, and the lasting impact it had on New Orleans and jazz music, plus much more. The last show was a Q&A episode where I answered questions on a variety of topics from listeners like you. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. Those are always fun, and I think you'll enjoy it. Before we jump in, let me talk about the people that make this show possible. Sunset Chasers is a company that helps if you need help planning a trip to New Orleans or really to anywhere. Mallory and Allison are two New Orleans locals. They're the travel advisors behind Sunset Chasers, and they can help you plan the perfect vacation to New Orleans. Let them help you make those vacation dreams a reality by scheduling a free 30-minute consultation call. Beyond Bourbon Street listeners save 15% if you choose to work with them using the code BEYOND15. Longtime listeners might remember that I used to offer travel planning services, but I had to stop as the podcast grew and as my kids got more involved in extracurriculars. I've been looking for a partner with a similar view on New Orleans, and I think I've found them in Mallory and Allison. Their prices are actually lower than mine were for a similar service, and they're able to offer a wider range of help if you want a more done-for-you experience. Check them out and let me know how it goes. You can find them at sunsetchaserstravelagency.com/call, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes, which will be over at beyondbourbonst.com/170. The most frequent questions I get are about moving to New Orleans. If you're ready to move, you need a good realtor, and that's where Liz Wood comes in. Let Liz and her team over at Liz Wood Realty help you find the right place. They can help you whether you plan to rent or purchase. Look, New Orleans is a wonderful town, but it's a city of neighborhoods. In fact, we're going to talk about neighborhoods today. And it can be a little overwhelming if you're moving to the city and trying to figure out where's the right fit for you. Liz makes that process fun and easy, and she also continues on after she helps you find a place to help you become part of the community. So reach out to Liz at LizWoodRealty.com and make your dream of living in New Orleans a reality. And finally, look, if you're working with Liz, you're going to need a secure financing probably. And that's where Tommy Manzella at Gulf Coast Mortgage comes in. Reach out to Tommy at Gulf Coast and let him help you get everything in place. We did that with our refi a couple years ago, and then we did it again when we were looking to move. And both times it was as smooth as could be. Links are in the show notes. And again, it's Tommy Manzella at Gulf Coast Bank. All right, let's jump into the main part of the show. As I mentioned at the top, today's episode is about Economy Hall, an organization that was founded in the 1800s to create and preserve a society for free men of color. It became so much more than that, including a hotbed of a new form of American music known as jazz. To help us dive into the topic, I'm joined by the author of the book named Economy Hall, Fatima Sheikh. Welcome to the show, Fatima. How are you?
Hi. Nice to be here, Mark.
It's really nice to meet you in person. I have sat with your book for, gosh, a couple of months, working my way through it and taking notes. And now to meet you in person, I'm really excited. So we should mention that the book is called Economy Hall, The Hidden History of a Free Black Brotherhood by Fatima Sheikh. It is published by the Historic New Orleans Collection, one of our sponsors, and we happen to be sitting in their space today, so I appreciate that. The book goes quite in depth. It's about 400 pages, but let's start with you. You grew up in New Orleans, right?
I sure did. I grew up in the 7th Ward of New Orleans, and my family has been in Louisiana for many generations.
Yeah. And did you raise your family here, your kids here?
Kids were born in New York. Okay. So I left New Orleans after college and went to New York because that's where I could become a book writer.
Right.
There weren't too many opportunities down here for book writers at the time I was growing up. And, you know, I had so many ambitions when I was young. So I had to go to New York Center of Publishing. So I find myself back here, back home.
All right. Well, it's good to have you home. I actually waited a while. I waited until you made a trip back home in order to do this in person so that we could sit across the table and talk. Mm-hmm. So the first thing I want to talk about with Economy Hall, I think most of us, myself included, if we know anything about Economy Hall, what we think of is the Jazz Fest tent.
Right.
And the Economy Hall Jazz Fest tent is where the traditional New Orleans jazz is played and performed. But if you are a listener and you're like me, you probably never thought anything more than that. in terms of why it's called Economy Hall. And we're going to get into that today. But I think as a starting point, can you kind of give us, and I know it was sort of in two places, but kind of give us the geography of where Economy Hall was located.
Okay. Economy Hall was where the 1400 block of Ursuline Street would be. What was really interesting about it is that there were three Economy Halls. Mm-hmm. There was a small building that they built at the back of what we would know now as the old Mayor, the Treme Mayor house, mm-hmm. which was the African-American Museum for a little while. The back of that was where the first Economy Hall building okay. was. It was a double that's no longer there. The second Economy Hall was across the street. That's the big hall that we know about. Mm-hmm. And that stood until 1965. And the next door to it is a little house that's still there, 1428 Ursuline, which was also owned by the Economy. So they had a presence on that same block from 1836, when they bought their first little building, to 1965.
Wow, that's yeah. pretty amazing legacy.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing that people would come there all of that time. You know, mm-hmm. you realize how much a community means to people when you know that they've been coming to the same block for year after year. Right?
Well, and that's one of the many things that struck me about your book is that it spans such a long period of time and so much change. Mm-hmm. You know, not only in the Black community, but in the United States. And in New Orleans, in particular, obviously it's set in New Orleans, but it spans such a huge length of the history of Louisiana and of the history of the U.S., and you kind of see those changes. I'm really interested, before we get into it, though, you have a really unique perspective on how you came to be interested in this. I think it's pretty amazing. So can you share with the listeners how you first learned about Economy Hall and what the personal significance was to you?
Well, the personal significance was that my father's friend was one of the last members of Economy Hall. So because it lasted till about 1965, right? Mm-hmm. So one of his friends was in charge of when they were leaving that building, the society was breaking up. The Economy Hall was built by the Société d'Économie, right? Mm-hmm. The Economy Society. And my father's friend was one of the last members of the Economy Society. They were getting rid of all of the furniture that was in the hall, and they had so many journals of minutes that they had for about 100 years. Nobody wanted the minutes. The minutes were in French. They were old books. Nobody wanted a bunch of old books, right? So my dad took them his friend sent them to the dump. Mm. And my father found the books on the back of a dump truck and brought them home, put them in the closet, and they sat there for about 50 years. So I knew all the time that there was some strange books in the closet, and he would look at them every once in a while, and I'd look at them every once in a while. Nobody did anything with them. So it was in 1997, actually, that I applied for a grant and got a grant to start reading the books. And when I started reading the books, I realized that the surnames that were in the books were my neighbors, the ancestors of my neighbors. So that had me hooked.
Yeah, that's what I find amazing. You talk about early in the book, a couple of the surnames were people you grew up with. You grew up with their descendants.
I definitely grew up with their descendants. I grew up, there were several of their descendants that were actually on my block. and the rest of them, many of the others, went to Corpus Christi school with me. So
really?
You know, so it was sort of like I saw just how this community had sort of morphed over the years, mm-hmm. but they really hadn't moved. Mm-hmm. They hadn't moved. They had stayed like either in the Treme or the 7th Ward or Gentilly, all these neighborhoods that we sort of know as kind of Creole neighborhoods.
And that's very, certainly up to Katrina, that was very, very typical of New Orleans. You know, we are very much a community of neighborhoods, and it wasn't unusual for people to not leave their neighborhood or maybe go a neighborhood adjacent.
Right. I don't think it's much different in the Black community than it was in the white community. You know, I mean,
right.
I think in people who have been here for any generation, they kind of stay where they were. They kind of knew the people, the same people, generation after generation, you know. Mm-hmm. It was fascinating to me when I actually got to read the words of the people who were there 100 years ago. That had me hooked.
Well, and it was all in French, correct?
It was all in French until 1928.
Okay.
So the around 1912, they started to write in English and French. And by 1928, it was exclusively in English.
Which I also think is really interesting in that it's easy to forget that from a historical perspective, that all the way essentially through the 1800s, New Orleans was primarily, you would hear French on the street.
Right.
Primarily.
Right.
You know, and even after the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, and you had this big influx of Americans, right? Mm-hmm. French, and to a lesser degree Spanish, but French was the language that you would hear, and certainly among the Creole population.
Yeah. I think French was the language. It was, even though we talk about the Americans coming right. in and the Americans dominating government and that sort of thing, I think among themselves, people spoke French.
Yeah.
You know, so it was the fact that they took their notes in French, the other societies around them, like the Jeunes Amis. Mm-hmm. I think I mentioned in the book that even English speakers call it the Jeunes Amis.
Right.
You know, nobody says the young friends, right? Although now there are the young friends. Right.
Right.
There are the young
Yeah,
friends.
There are. Yeah. So that was like an amazing thing to me that you essentially sat, one, that your father, through whatever reason, kept these books. Two, that you know, after all those years, you became interested in them and find this very, very hyper-local connection. But the third thing is that these men from the very beginning kept very detailed minutes and records. And it seemed that that was important to them. It was their own way, as I read your book, it was their own way of keeping sort of a social structure and having some control over their lives. And again, you talk about, maybe you can share with us, when exactly the society was created.
Okay. Well, the society was created in 1836, which was a pivotal time in New Orleans. You know, mm-hmm. Americans were coming in a little bit. The Haitian Revolution had been gone maybe about a generation, but there were a lot of people who spoke French from the Haitian Revolution. And these men had enough liberty to be able to buy real estate, to lend each other money. They had money, you know, they had education. Some of them had trained in France, other people had tutors. But I found that it was very important to them to keep minutes of their meetings. And in fact, you find the word posterity in there a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, they will talk about what their legacy is going to be. You know, so for me, picking up the books, I had to do something because this was their legacy. Their legacy was important to them.
Yeah, and that's yeah. obvious almost from day one mm-hmm. in your book, that yeah. they had a sense of not only trying to make the world better for their community in the moment, mm-hmm. but also going forward. And there's lots of examples about, essentially, my words, trying to be a good example for their future ancestors.
Right, I think they did. I think they were trying to create institutions that would stand mm-hmm. for their ancestors, you know, and for the people at large, because their goal was to educate one another, to help one another, and to reach out to suffering humanity. So that suffering humanity part was like really important. It's kind of ambiguous, right? Mm-hmm. Because they started at the time of slavery. So right. suffering humanity racially was their people.
Right.
Because they do mention about their African blood. So they're mm-hmm. interested in that. But you also have to understand that at this time, there were laws against them mentioning their oppression. In fact, there was a law that said for anyone to speak about their oppression, even in private, they could go to jail. So the fact that they mentioned suffering humanity and the things that they're doing for each other, they sort of downplay what they're doing. But basically what they're doing is setting up institutions, creating old folks homes and charities and things like that to help people out.
Sure, and education mm-hmm. opportunities.
Educational opportunities, yeah.
I also found it fascinating, as is so much the case in New Orleans, so much of our history is messy and convoluted, that you had these free men of color, and yet some of them were slave owners.
Yeah.
And so you had this real kind of dichotomy of how do you reconcile that? And in some cases, some of the central characters, I call them characters, okay. but actual people in your book later freed their slaves. You go into a story about someone's mom and an, kind of an argument in the courts about, you know, obviously slaves were property. So was this property or was this person freed? And so even while they are trying to establish this sort of order and community and benevolent society for people, they are also wrestling with this weirdness, right? That yeah. some of them are slaveholders.
Yeah, it took me 20 years to write this book, okay? Mm-hmm. And those were one of some of the things that slowed me down. I had to try to figure out what kind of people were these. Mm. Who were these people, right? How could a person who was of African descent own another person of African descent, right?
Right.
How could they do this? Some of them did free their slaves. Now you have to think, or the enslaved, you have to think about this in terms of how much that cost. Mm-hmm. And I know this sounds really crass, but like in real terms, right?
Sure.
This was the equivalent of a house. So when you freed someone, it's like giving a person a house, mm-hmm. okay? So I found several people that freed people, right? So they gave them the house. The laws in Louisiana were also that if you freed someone in the 1830s, they had to leave the state.
Right.
So now you're going to give someone their freedom. You love them enough to give them the equivalent of a house, and now you're never going to see them again.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm grappling with this when I'm writing. Are these people keeping people enslaved because they're under their protection and they don't have to leave the state? Are they keeping them enslaved because they're exploiting them,
mm-hmm.
right? And I'm not saying that they didn't exploit them too. I think,
sure.
you know, the conclusion that I came out, well, two conclusions. One thing was that I was going to write the truth. Okay, I was just going to go down, I was going to look at the records, and I was going to say, this is what the record says,
mm-hmm.
right? And I'm not going to sugarcoat it one way or another. The other thing I realized was that people are people, and I look at it like today, you know, there are people who have immigrants who don't have working papers in the United States, right?
Right.
There are some people who will hire an immigrant and hold it over their heads. If you don't do what I tell you to do, I'm going to tell the police and I'm going to have you arrested and sent back, right? There are some people that will help this person get an education, get their children on their feet and help them get citizenship if they want, right? There are some people who will just like really help them. I think human nature doesn't change. And I think that the people who would have been mean to someone now, the people who are mean mm-hmm. to people now would be the same people who were mean to people back then. The people who are exploitive now are the same people who would be exploitive back then. And same goes with generosity. The people who would be generous and helpful now would be the same kind of people. Mm. I don't think human nature changes. So you'll find some people who are exploitive.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find some people who be generous.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah. So that brings up something. We're going to come back to the 1830s, 1840s, but I had a question for later on that you just brought up, or an observation. And one of the things that hit me as I went through the book is, you know, we sit here in late 2022, and it's a time where the country's really divided. And we're divided not only among some things that I would sort of call frivolous and arguing, but we're divided over real beliefs that people have one way or the other, and about things like immigration and abortion and just all kinds of things. But what it boils down to me, maybe overly simplified, is about who controls whose rights.
Yeah.
And when I finished the book recently, it struck me that while it feels like in 2022, this is such a unique moment in time and sort of a crisis, and perhaps it is, that in many ways, it's the same thing of a different flavor that was happening in the 1830s through 1900, right? That you portray in your book. You had this period of time where slaveholding was still common, and mm-hmm. really for the first 30 years, 25 years of the period that the society existed, they were having to reconcile with this whole issue of slavery and the enslaved, and do you free them? And some of the rights were constantly changing, mm-hmm. and the laws about what went into being allowed to free someone and the cost that you mentioned. And then as we jump forward, we'll get to in a moment, you get to the period of Reconstruction and all the challenges there. And it really struck me that in many ways, history does repeat itself. And when you break it down, regardless of whether you're Republican or Democrat or wherever you fall in the political spectrum, we're kind of going through the same thing again, right? This sort of fighting over who gets to decide what people's rights are.
Right. I think that as I was writing the book, I saw history repeating itself, you know? I saw history repeating itself in the way that people's rights were taken away,
mm-hmm.
right? Because during that period of Reconstruction, finally the things that the men in the economy wanted, equality, right? They mm-hmm. had equality. They could run for office. They could make laws. They could, you know, they could go to schools. The schools were integrated. Public transportation was, everything was, you know, finally sort of equal. And then you saw the way that their rights were eroded. And they were eroded through states' rights.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They were eroded through violence. They were eroded, the first way they were eroded was through propaganda, you know, which was mm-hmm. really funny to me. I mean, not funny, ha-ha funny, but
right.
it was unusual, thought it was unusual, but actually it's fairly common. The propaganda about them mm-hmm. was that all of these stereotypes that we know as stereotypes, right?
Mm-hmm.
The came across in the newspapers, which was the media, major media of the day.
Right.
So the fact that we're seeing a lot of stereotypes and sort of news that is not true, right? We're arguing over facts. I could just see the way that people back then were arguing over facts too, right?
Right.
Are these free people of color really terrible, and are they going to upset the country?
Mm-hmm.
Or are they going to be good citizens? Are the enslaved going to be good citizens when they get their freedom? Or are they going to wreck everything? And mm-hmm. this is the same kind of arguments people are saying about immigrants that are coming in right now. Right?
You know, in a weird sort of way, as I read the book, it gave me some comfort in the sense of, we have been through this before, mm-hmm. and it is very difficult, mm-hmm. but we have survived it, mm-hmm. and we have figured out how to do it, and there will probably always be tensions in this country and in the world. And it, you know, your book lays out clearly through this perspective of free men of color and the enslaved, and then exactly as you talked about what changes over time. So they begin the society in the 1830s, and they are first fighting to kind of establish and preserve their basic rights and to expand them and to help the enslaved. You mentioned, or I mentioned, the word benevolent, but very mm-hmm. much trying to take care of people in their community, right. Really hyper-local. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an exhibit going on right now here at the Historic New Orleans Collection about the Spanish and Caribbean influence in Louisiana, and you certainly refer to the Caribbean influence mm-hmm. in the book, you know, as people are coming from Saint-Domingue, from present-day Haiti. Mm-hmm. But you tell this story primarily through one central character or mm-hmm. person, I'll try my best, Luger Bogeal.
Mm-hmm.
And why did you choose Bogeal as kind of the person through whom you would tell the story?
The first reason I chose Bogeal is because I saw his handwriting. Mm-hmm. And his handwriting is gorgeous if you ever see the book. He's very expressive. It's very clear. And he actually, when he took minutes, he numbered the movements in the meeting. So it was really easy. It was almost like he had an index so I could look and see what they were doing at any given time, right? That was the first thing. And then secondly, because he had such a long lifespan, he lived from 1812 to 1892. So that really paralleled a very important time in America
mm-hmm.
through enslavement, through Reconstruction, through post-Reconstruction, right up until Plessy,
right.
Ferguson. And then the third reason was his parents came from Haiti.
Right.
And I was able to find traces of the places where his parents came from. So I could really see sort of this revolutionary spirit and this spirit for equal rights that moved from Haiti to Louisiana, you know, and then to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to realize that in the United States, the free people of color in New Orleans were, well, they were 45% of the African-Americans, I shouldn't say African-Americans, but I should say people of African descent who were in New Orleans.
Yeah.
They were 45%. So they had a critical mass
mm-hmm.
enough to have schools and to have, so when Reconstruction came, when they did get their rights, they could run for office, they could read the bills, they could write the bills. You know what I mean? They could do things that people said they couldn't do because other places didn't have as much education and as much critical mass of people with literacy.
Mm-hmm.
So Bogeal was right in there.
Yeah.
And Bogeal seemed to be on the stage at every time something was happening, he was there. He was at the first colored convention of Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a French speaker, so somebody gave a speech about rights in English. He gave the speech about rights in French.
Mm-hmm.
So he was fascinating.
Yeah, he strikes me as someone that enjoyed being in the center of it,
mm-hmm.
but also seemed to have this kind of forward-looking view.
Yeah.
He was very careful, I would say, about it. It felt like almost every word he wrote, he was thinking about someone else reading those words.
Yeah.
And so we have this kind of beautiful history through what on one level would seem mundane, these minutes of these mm-hmm. meetings, right? And who attended and what they attended to and you know, down to some minuscule, should we help this person? Should we do this? How much money should we spend here?
Mm-hmm.
He also, along with the other leaders in the society, felt it was important to have a hall, to have a place right. to meet that was theirs.
Right.
And there was a lot of consternation about that, because when that was built, that was still at the time of the enslaved. And
at the time it was built, actually, by the time it was finished, the Dred Scott decision had happened, which said it was in 1857. December of 1857, the hall was opened.
Mm-hmm.
But in March 1857, 1857, the United States Supreme Court said that people of African descent were slaves, were born to be slaves, and would never become citizens. So that year was really pivotal for them. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Bogill was taking the notes. So mm-hmm. I got to see all of the emotions that people were having. There were more fights among themselves.
Yep.
Somebody committed suicide. They opened up the hall. And then what was interesting, you know, you say at the beginning, which is true, at the beginning it was hyper-local, right? That these men, there were 15 men, they took care of their families, and they took care, and by taking care, they buried them, they took care of their health, they mm-hmm. helped each other, right? But by the time they opened their hall, they opened the hall to everyone. So they started out as a very small organization, and then they opened their doors to everyone. And then when the laws were changed, right, when slavery was over, they opened their halls to everyone in the city. So you saw, not only did the formerly enslaved come to register to vote
right.
in the hall, registered to vote before the amendments were passed even, they came to the hall. You saw cigar workers met in the hall. The Republican Party came into the hall. They had their first convention in Economy Hall. The German workers came to the hall. So they really opened it up to the city, which makes me believe that is the reason Economy Hall, like the Jazz Fest chant, mm-hmm. is so close to everybody. I think we all sort of have this historical feeling about it. You know, we
right.
know it through the music, right?
Right, right?
And we're touched by that music. All
sure.
of us are touched by that music. I have a feeling it's because Economy Hall was opened its doors to everybody.
Mm.
And everybody sort of was touched then, you know?
Mm-hmm. And there were certainly periods, and you chronicled this through the book, just kind of like the rise and fall of, so we get beyond the period of slavery and then we get into Reconstruction, and there's this openness and this welcoming mm-hmm. and including a bit of across races.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's this moment, the decades really, where all of a sudden these men come to some power and they can run for office and they are helping the entire community. And then they start to hit, you know, as Bogill gets older, then we start to hit this down cycle where now we're starting to get, you know, the pushback on Reconstruction and then what ultimately becomes Jim Crow.
Yeah.
And you see, again, that documented through the society minutes
right.
and the changes and what they try to do. And they sort of close ranks a little bit, it feels like, to protect themselves and to protect the community that they've helped foster all these years.
Right. They did close ranks. You know, a lot of people don't know about that period of Reconstruction because it was only a decade.
Mm.
In that decade, all of the people who were enslaved were supposed to get it together. So what you had were a lot of people coming in from the country towns and coming to New Orleans. So what you saw people in the economy doing, like Lou Jabogie was opening up schools.
Mm-hmm.
He had a school. His wife had a school. His wife was a principal of the school. The pushback started when in education, mm-hmm. which doesn't surprise, you
right.
know, you can look at the parallels, right?
Right.
It started in education. People were upset that these people were getting free education, and they started threatening school teachers, threatening, you know, children going to school. So you saw this sort of violence ramp up,
mm-hmm.
right? It might be in a small country town where somebody was trying to go to school, but then it kind of spread into the city until you got things like what they call the Battle of Liberty Place.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Because the metropolitan people, a lot of people don't know that during Reconstruction, the police force was integrated.
Right.
Right. So you had an integrated police force. During the time of the Battle of Liberty Place, there was a fight.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, there was no Liberty Place until 10 years later. But there was a fight. Several of the Metropolitan Police Force died. Maybe one person on the other side died. Some of the people who died were members of Economy Hall.
Mm.
So what I saw in the minutes were them mourning their friends, and deciding that even though there was this pushback on their rights, that they would now hire a band,
mm-hmm.
a brass band, to march with them. And every time they would go out, like for, you know, the opening of a store, I guess, or funeral, or every time they would march, they all had to march. This was about 100 guys, at
mm-hmm.
least 100 guys. They would have to be in uniform. They would march behind a brass band. This, to me, was their trying to state, well, we're not going to lose our rights. We're going to try to keep our rights. Well, unfortunately, there was a lot more violence.
Right.
For people who don't know the history, that is kind of repeating a little bit now, right?
Mm-hmm.
There was violence at the polls. There were tests so people wouldn't come to vote, but a lot of people started staying away from the polls because it became dangerous to go vote.
Mm-hmm.
Dangerous or difficult. You know, you had to, I don't know, recite all of the members of Congress backwards or something.
Sure.
I mean, it became really difficult to go to the polls. And so the vote was lost, and you saw this Jim Crow come
mm-hmm.
in.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sort of at the same time, you had all that going on. This is where we start to get into the beginnings of jazz.
That's right.
One of the things that really interested me, again, and I was drawn to the book because mm-hmm. of the name Economy Hall. You really don't get to jazz until maybe the back quarter or fifth of the book, right? Because that's really not the story, as it turns out. The story is this legacy, I think, in my words, this legacy of this community that was founded to take care of themselves and then eventually a bigger community. Mm-hmm. And like any organization that's around for so long, it ebbs and flows, and it hits high points and it hits challenges. Mm-hmm. And they talk about members not being able to afford the dues and stepping up to your civic responsibility. Mm-hmm. But then you get to this point that you just talked about or started to talk about, with all of a sudden there's a brass band mm-hmm. and there's a procession and a big deal made about every business opening or every momentous thing that happens. And a couple of things struck me when I read it. The first thing that hit me was, boy, that sounds in many ways like today's Second Lines,
right?
You know, and the pageantry. And I'm not talking about the second lines that follow a funeral. I'm talking about the second lines on Sundays here in New Orleans that are very much a celebration, often of benevolent societies or societies that started as benevolent societies. And there's two important parts to that. One is the music and the other is the dress. Like, people really dress up and come out, show out for those events. And when I first read that in your book, I thought, boy, that's really similar to a tradition that continues to this day.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not that is by design or maybe by inherited oral history or whatever it is, there's a direct tie to what these men were doing in that.
There is a direct line. There is a direct line. These men were processing, right, to show their power and their strength, that they had rights, they had achieved their rights, and they were not going to lose their rights, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they would come down the street in their uniforms with the band, and it was a powerful image, if you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
You find that some of the benevolent societies, sort of social and pleasure clubs, mm-hmm. called, that started, that say that they had a long history, that they started in the 19th century, were meeting at Economy Hall.
Right.
Yeah. So you'll see some, like the Young Friends, Les Jeunes Amis, right?
Yeah.
Young and True Friends, the Sincere Amis, right? The Sincere Friends. Some of these groups started in the 19th century. Some of them met at Economy Hall, and that was a place where people departed. Like, they started, they all met at Economy Hall to take the march, right? So I think there's a direct line to that. There is, as you said, some pride even in today's marches, that
Definitely.
Everybody dresses a certain way, they hold their heads up, and they march. I think that is that same spirit of democracy and equality that they're trying to show, that pride, right? You know?
Yeah.
It's still here.
And I think I mention it because I think one of the things we encourage people to do on the podcast is get out to a second line. You
mm-hmm.
know, we have this long second line season that's just about to wind down here mm-hmm. as we start November 2022. But it's a long season. And even today, when you go to a second line, there's this sense of pride, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes under pressure of, you know, there's been a thing the last couple of years about the city and the police pushing back on permits and what's allowed and what's not allowed. And you see these organizations, again, almost all of them rooted in some form of benevolent society, mm-hmm. who will come and dress out and share the culture. And it's a really authentic expression of an important part of New Orleans that really traces back to this.
Right. It's an authentic expression of pride, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it started, it probably, like you said, came through oral history many times,
mm-hmm.
right? Because there aren't many written journals of these organizations. Right?
Right.
So it was an expression of pride that was passed down. And people follow them. And if you notice, the communities around them, the people that know them, are there to urge them on.
Right.
They're there to encourage them. And I believe this is in parallel to what was going on in Economy Hall.
Mm-hmm.
What happened, right, after the violence started and people were being pushed away from the polls was that people started coming into Economy Hall sort of as a safe space.
Yeah, as almost a refuge, right?
Right, almost as a refuge. The same things that they did, the same things that the economists did all along, have dances, raise money for the poor by having concerts, or the same things went on, but now they went on in a segregated community, in a refuge, right?
Yeah.
What you saw was that the members and their friends became musicians or had musicians in their families. So they supported the musicians and their families by having these parties and these dances, kept everybody safe, and it kept a little money circulating in the community.
Right, and you talk about, you know, obviously then we're entering the Jim Crow era and certainly segregation, and so these early founders, if you will, of this uniquely American music, jazz, all of them essentially performed at Economy Hall. Yeah. It was known as a hopping place. And you talk about the Historic New Orleans Collection did a thing during COVID with kind of a March Madness kind of bracket style of music. And one of the selections was, I'm going to screw up I don't have it bookmarked and I'm going to screw up the title, but I Wish I Could Shake It Like My Sister Kate,
right?
And you talk about, that was one of the songs that the Historic New Orleans Collection used in sort of its bracket.
Right.
But you had all these big band leaders and everybody from Louis Armstrong to Sidney Bechet to just about anybody you could think of that was foundational to the beginnings of jazz music played Economy Hall.
Right. William Nickerson was a member. Mertil Piron was a president. Armand Piron was his nephew. He played there, his orchestra. And he wrote, I Wish I Could Shimmy Like My Sister Kate.
Okay.
Right? He and Clarence Williams, I think, or Williams, I remember was the last name. They co-wrote that. But so you saw there in the Hogan Jazz Archives, I found 100 oral histories that mention Economy Hall.
Hmm. Wow.
So all of these guys played. Lorenzo Tio was there. I mean, everybody who was anybody came to Economy Hall.
Yeah, it was amazing to me because I think when I think of the roots of jazz, I think about Black Storyville and White Storyville, right? And so much of the music was played there, and these same musicians would have played in those places. But in Economy Hall, they had a safe spot among their community, and it was sort of probably perpetuating that, right? Teaching younger members and teaching, kind of forwarding that music history that lives on today in the community.
Right. It started out like Economy Hall was sort of a classy place to be, so you'd go there for waltzes and dances with an orchestra, and it sort of morphed into jazz. I think Michael White told me, think about jazz like people look at hip-hop. You know, the way hip hop came in, that people were at first like, oh, I don't know, you know, and then after a while, everybody sort of picks up on the rhythm.
Right.
You know, so it said, well, it started out with these classical orchestras, and then you'd have a few musicians like Louis Armstrong who played there, right, who were non-reading musicians, and they would add their influence. And you saw Kid Ory then hiring out Economy Hall every Monday night. So it sort of morphed into this jazz that we know.
Yeah. You know, I think it's amazing. I also think geographically, New Orleans is a small city, relatively. And all of this is happening not very far from Congo Square.
No.
You know, and that was not lost on me in the roots of music and also the memory of the enslaved and the struggles there. Right. All of this was within relatively easy walking distance. Right. And so you have this thread, again, that goes from the 1820s, 1830s, all the way through, well after the period of slavery ended, but through Reconstruction and then into the challenges into, you know, as we jump all the way forward into the Jim Crow era. And there's just kind of this very, all in a very compact geography, a couple square miles at best, right? It's pretty amazing to me.
Really, a few blocks you can easily walk from. You can probably hear the music in Congo Square to Ursuline Street, right?
Yeah,
It drums, right? The drums circles, which still go on in Congo Square, right? You could hear that. And Goshawk wrote about the Bambula and Congo Square. So he sort of brought it into a written composition. You also had composers like Bessie Barre, who played at Economy Hall, who was an enslaved man when he was making his compositions. So there was a lot of cross-pollinization right there. Yeah.
And that probably is a quick segue into, I want to mention our last sponsor. I've mentioned them several times. Support for the podcast does come from the place where we're sitting, the Historic New Orleans Collection. They're the city's premier history museum. They happen to be the publisher of your book. They're located at 520 Royal Street in the heart of the quarter. One of the things they've done that I really like is they have an online publication called First Draft It's kind of a combination of a blog and an online exhibition. You can find it at hnoc.org/firstdraft. Starting recently, it just started October 20th and running through January 22nd of 2023, they're presenting an exhibit entitled Spanish, New Orleans, and the Caribbean. And really, it's about the influence of the Spanish and the Caribbean on New Orleans. And, you know, while we call it the French Quarter, there's this amazing amount of Spanish influence for the 60 years that the Spaniards were in charge of New Orleans. The exhibit includes about 125 pieces, both from the collection's own collection, as well as other museums across the United States and Spain. So if you want to hear more, listen to episode 168 with Alfred Lemon, who is just a riot of a guest and is so passionate about the work that is going on in this specific exhibit. And then go to hnoc.org/visit to plan your trip. I want to get back to the discussion with Fatima Sheikh, again, author of the book Economy Hall, which was published by the Historic New Orleans Collection. What surprised you as you went through the history and the books and tried to put this into, you know, into one sort of chronology?
There were so many surprising things. What surprised me the most, though, that this was that this history hadn't been written before.
Mm-hmm.
That was the thing that really surprised me. All of these people had been quoted, not all of these people, but the major people that I write about had been quoted like in the New York Times, had been written about in the daily newspaper, had been written about in the Tribune, like, totally, but nobody knows the history, right? So that really surprised me that we know Economy Hall, the tent, the Jazz Fest, so well. People all around the world know the Economy, but nobody knew the people who built it.
Yeah.
So that really surprised me, the fact that I was going to be the one to write the story.
Yeah, I was really taken aback by that. And so much so, it surprises me. And if anyone's listening from the Jazz and Heritage Foundation, and I think I'm going to reach out to them, I would love to see a plaque or a little bit of an exhibit outside of Economy Hall that talks about, I would assume your book is probably sold at the tent right near there or should be sold there. So there's a plug. But that seems like an opportunity to put something right outside of the Economy Hall tent, sort of about what Economy Hall is, because so many people like myself were just totally ignorant of, I could make the guess that Economy Hall was a place. I was thinking like the Eagle Saloon,
right,
and was a place that was the sort of among the birthplaces of jazz, but had no idea that it was really sort of in the latter third of the life of the Economy Hall and the society that it came into play, and that there was so much that was a foundation for it,
yeah,
right, to happen.
Economy Hall was a foundation for democracy, right? Mm. You know, when people talk about where democracy, the ideals, who upheld the ideals of democracy? Well, a lot of people upheld the ideals of democracy. But in New Orleans, Economy Hall played a big part of it, because they were all about justice. They had the first integrated party, you know, there in the South, right? They had the voter registration. They were really about it. And even when they did their marches, it was about, well, we are citizens, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'd love to see a plaque about Economy Hall. That's on my bucket list, to hold up the book at the Economy Hall Jazz Tent.
I think it would be fascinating, and I think people would love it, right? Because people that are drawn to the tent are drawn to those older musicians. And often, as much as the music is fabulous at the tent, for me, the best moments are when, and those artists are disappearing, but when you see those old guys stop and talk a little bit,
right,
about the history, right?
Yeah.
Because then, and we make a huge jump, you go through this period of Jim Crow and segregation, and really it's not until Preservation Hall, in many senses, that they have a place to sort of play. And even then, you know, it was owned by a white family that, you know, Ben Jaffe still owns it. And even then, at first, they had to do it kind of on the down low.
Yeah.
You know, it was
the integrated audience. Right. Yeah.
They weren't performing. They were sort of practicing. And, you know, for a few bucks or a donation, the Jaffes would kind of host these salons, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So you really had this long, long period of, where did they play and how did they preserve their music and how did they make a living? And many of these musicians, including Louis Armstrong, obviously, ended up having to go to other places,
right,
to make a living, you know. But the society in the early days provided a place for income and a place for safety and where they could be not only accepted but celebrated.
Right. They were celebrated for the musicians they were, not for the oddities that came mm-hmm. out of this experience, right? They were celebrated for being really good musicians, you know? And they were, and they played not only at Economy Hall, but they were little, you know, there were little places like when I was coming up, you know, mm-hmm. you could go hear musicians, but they were segregated, mm-hmm. you know? They were segregated. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that Economy Hall in the 1850s had a place where the doors were open to everybody really means a lot. We should know that history.
Yes.
And we shouldn't forget that people liked each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we shouldn't forget that New Orleanians have liked each other for a long time. And that even though we have these divisions now, a lot of these divisions are artificial.
Mm-hmm.
They're created by media. They're created like they were created in the 1850s and 60s with propaganda. A lot of these divisions that are being created right now are created by propaganda. So we have to know that our own interests lie in being nice to each other.
Hmm. That's a great way to put it. And I think, you know, New Orleans, for all its challenges, and there are many, I think there are things that bring us all together, regardless mm-hmm. of race and ethnicity and religion and politics. And music is one of them. Mm-hmm. And our culture, right, is another. You see people of all walks of life enjoying the Mardi Gras Indians and Jazz Fest and Mardi Gras in general and the weekend celebrations. And you were talking about Gottschalk and Bambula and his recollection of Congo Square. And now we have music in Congo Square pretty regularly again.
Right.
We have festivals there, right?
Let's hope it continues.
Yes.
Yes.
You know, and sort of coming full circle. And again, this community we've spent the last 45 minutes talking about all right there. You know, for me, it just opened my eyes because, again, all I knew was the Economy Hall Jazz Tent. I think it's an important story. I know that the book has just come out or is about to come out in paperback. It is a book that I would encourage you to buy in hardback because it's a beautiful book. I think it's a great book to reference and to share with people. It seems like it almost happened by accident that your dad happened to keep these things and you happened to know and then one day develop an interest. It's a real interesting walk through a lot of time, 120 years essentially. Thank you so much for writing this book, but thank you for sharing your insight into it. I appreciate it, Fatima.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here today.
We will put links to where people can get the book online. Again, I cannot recommend it enough. It is a lengthy book, so it takes some time to read it, but it is very much, again, my impressions were one stepping back in history and thinking about traditions and how important they were. I also, incidentally, as I was reading it, I thought about the Zulu Social Aid and Pleasure Club. And I think they had some ties in that, you know, they came along in the 19-aughts. But you can see very much sort of an outgrowth of trying to preserve tradition and culture and history there and some benevolence there. And that was so important to the community, right? It's the only way in many cases that people could survive and support each other. And that's still important today in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. So thank you again. We'll put links in the show notes. Please check out the book. And I'm going to do my part. And I'm looking at my friends at the Historic New Orleans Collection here. I think collectively we can put some pressure on the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation and maybe get a plaque or a note or something there. That stage, if you will, is right almost adjacent to there's a book tent where you can buy books. And I'm going to push hard to see that this book makes it into that inventory next year so that when you're enjoying Jazz Fest, you can go to Economy Hall and then walk right next door and pick up the book. I just think it's that important. And I think it's a wonderfully written book. So thank you.
Thank you.
I hope that as listeners, when you visit Jazz Fest in the years to come, when you enter Economy Hall, you'll have a better appreciation for the history behind it. Again, I would encourage you to pick up the book. Thanks, as always, to our sponsors, and thanks to you for listening. With that, I'm going to turn it over to my kids to close us out.
New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with someone else who loves New Orleans as much as you do. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.